Welcome to Business Insights. I would like to thank you for tuning in. There's a lot of content out there, so you spending this hour with us means a great deal. This show is my opportunity to share the entrepreneurial success stories of our local business owners, and I encourage you to join me each week as we profile a new member of our business community. My guest today is Kendra Simmons of Antiques on Queen in downtown Port Hope. Kendra was born in Peterborough. She had moved over the period of her career from Toronto to Ottawa and finally resided back into Cobourg. Kendra, can you just tell me a little bit about the timeline of when you grew up? You were born in Peterborough, and then where do you go from there?
So then went to Toronto, where I went to college, George Brown College, for jewelry arts and design. Actually, I need to step back. Before that, I went to England, went to Camberwell School of Arts and Crafts, then came back, went to Toronto. That's where I met my husband, and then got offered some good work in Ottawa and moved over there. Opened a shop in Ottawa, and then decided to be closer to family, and due to health conditions with our child, we decided to move to Port Hope, which is an hour in those days to Toronto and back, and close to Peterborough.
So I just want to just delve into that quickly. You went over to England. Whereabouts were you studying?
It was called Camberwell School of Arts and Crafts. I started in bookbinding and went on to jewelry arts.
Very fascinating. I guess that gives you a lot of applicational skills for what you're doing now, or was there a lot of theory and everything that went behind that?
The theory was more in the gem department, where you had to get your gem degree and appraisal degrees, but the rest was all applicable, hands-on, learning how to do things.
And then you come back to Toronto. What did you study there?
Jewelry arts and design, first at wasn't called OCAD in those days, and then George Brown, which was the practical. Even in those days, college was practical and hands-on.
Right. From this, you get a good education, you have a broad understanding of the field. You said you moved into a business opportunity after that. What did that look like?
We opened up a vintage clothing and jewelry shop in Ottawa, and then started to get government contracts where I designed clothing for the historical houses, for the tour guides, and then also did appraisals for the government. So when people donated things to the government, it had to be appraised for their tax receipt, and sometimes even had to go to court to substantiate when they contested what the value that we gave it and what they thought the value of it was.
That's very fascinating. So give us a few examples. Which museums, I guess this is obviously historical houses that have period costume associated with it. People are donating different pieces. What exactly did this look like from your perspective? You get the item, you would appraise it, and then they would put it into the museum?
Yes, or again, vaults and vaults of storage items. But the moment anyone donates anything to any type of nonprofit or historical, the museums, they would get a tax receipt in kind or donation.
Right.
So a value has to be set. And what you would do is you would get three broad amounts and then come up with an average one. I think the best one was when a man donated a hat, and his family had been hat makers. So of course I gave it a value of, I think $195. Well, of course he contested it and thought that it should be worth $10,000. And I actually had to go to court to prove how I came up with the value of the hat.
Right.
It happened to be his family that was the factory manufacturer of the hat. But in the real world, once they're out there in the market, this is the price of what they are.
Right. Okay, that's interesting. Can you just quickly tell us a little bit about the research and the process that goes behind determining these values? I guess you can look at previous prices for something similar, but also the uniqueness of that item. What does that process kind of look like?
It's a lot different now than 35 years ago, because now we have the internet. Mm-hmm. Back then, you would have to call many, many, I guess in this case, vintage clothing dealers or hat dealers to find out what the average price of that particular hat would be. Because you'd have the model, the style number, the age, and then you would take all of those averages and come up with a mutually beneficial price to everyone.
Sure. That's very fascinating. And you did that for a few years. How long were you in Ottawa for?
We were in Ottawa for 9 years.
For 9 years?
9 years.
And that gave you a lot of practical experience from both running that business, but also from seeing unique items come in and then having to put a number to it, which I guess obviously leads into more facets of your business. You then make a move down to Port Hope. You open a store on Queen Street. At the time, was it called Antiques on Queen?
No, Chatwood and Simmons, which is what our corporation name is, but then we have other shops.
Okay. When you come down here, does it change a little bit from what you were doing in Ottawa, or is it a similar style down here?
I think it tailored more to mainly jewelry and some antiques as opposed to the vintage clothing aspect. Again, 35 years ago, vintage clothing was a hot trend. We had all the restaurant people coming in to buy white crisp shirts, the old leathers, and what's really interesting, actually, there's a shop that's just opened in Coburg a couple of years ago, maybe, called Little Underground. And it's exactly what our shop was back then.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Very interesting. You've moved back to Port Hope at this time. Do you have children?
We had a son. Yes.
Okay.
And long story short, we ended up having to go to sick kids every week. So hence, it made more sense to be in the Port Hope area where you just hop on the 401.
Sure.
And you could get in and out of Toronto in an hour.
Unlike today. Okay, you open up the store. What are you doing more or less in order to attract business at that time?
Well, at that time, Port Hope was the hub of antique shops. At any given time, there might have been 20 to 25 shops in that town.
Right.
When we first moved here, we bought a house in Coburg, thought we would open the shop there. And as soon as I was in town, I knew right away we had to be over in Port Hope to be with all the other shops.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we were already well known because we had had a business in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
We had had a business in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
And that corridor.
Yes.
So people would stop on the way from Ottawa going to the city and vice versa, going to Kingston or whatever. So we had already had built up a base of a clientele.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, people drove for the excitement and the thrill of the find.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would just advertise through radio, through print,
mm-hmm.
and the people would find you.
So can you just give us a date of when this kind of started? What year would have that been?
1989.
Okay, so 1989, there's about 20 to 25 antique stores in downtown Port Hope. It clearly was a draw in itself.
Huge draw, yeah. And again, for shops, some of them were group shops, so there was many under one roof, which right now I have some representation in my shop as well, like specialists. So there wasn't 25 bricks and mortar shops, but there must have been 10 or 12 anyway of actual buildings.
Right. You open up the store, you have a component that is vintage clothing, and that was pretty hot at the time, but you really developed your jewelry line at that time. So how do you source these things? What kind of contacts? Is it a small community so you get to know each other really well? How does that work?
In those days, yes, it was a small community, but we also buy whole estates where we deal with lawyers and trust companies. I have a unique situation where I'm a certified appraiser. So a lot of times when families or the lawyers open up the safety deposit boxes or go through the house, they actually find our appraisals. So that gives them a first entry of contact.
Right.
And now we're well known in that field, so we get called to evaluate at all times.
It opens up a different channel for yourself, of course, but ultimately, I think people nowadays, more than ever, get nervous about putting a price tag on something without having a professional give their two cents on it, because ultimately that could land back on and their responsibility for not having the right value.
Absolutely. Yeah, they have to do their due diligence.
And so you were into this jewelry and into different products that you'd find in an estate. When did you start making that a bigger part of your business, when you were starting to do estate appraisals for an entire estate?
It was always part of our business. Hence, when in Ottawa, I was able to do the government appraisals for tax purposes.
So that really carried over. Okay.
Yes.
Just curious, and this is again, because if a listener is looking to get into this kind of field, what are the type of steps that you would take? You have to get your credential in order to do this, but also you have to make people aware. What would you say are the steps that you would take in order to be well known for this, I guess?
I think first, education is the most important part. Definitely you'd want to get your appraisal papers. Both Canada has a GIA, the States, and then England. England is 100% scientific. I mean, it was, I think, three times before I passed it. whereas in the States, it's more practical. You look at the stones, you know how to evaluate them. But for the British papers, you have to actually know the chemical components of all of the minerals. So it's a lot, and not as applicable to what I do
right.
when you're looking at stones. The other thing is my specialty is still in the antique and estate jewelry. I am not, people bring me really modern pieces. Sometimes I have to refer them to someone else because I haven't kept up with science and the way things are changing.
Sure.
Synthetic stones, color enhancement. So there's other specialists now that are more aware of what's happening currently. But
right.
most people come to me specifically because I specialize in antique and estate and styles.
And again, in most estates, what you'll find is
yes.
jewelry that is from a different era.
Yeah.
And ultimately, when anybody takes a look at it, they may be confused of its original source, what it is. But your expertise would obviously lend to that specific.
Yeah, if it's been altered. And again, when I'm saying antique and estate, I'm thinking, like, if I look at things from the 90s, I'm good. But if I look at something that was made in China 5 years ago, I'm not good.
Right. Very fascinating. So fast forward, you've been on Queen Street for several years. You moved to Walton Street. What sparked the move to Walton Street?
A great building.
Okay.
Good bones. And also, Queen Street was evolving and changing. I was in, my shop is where now the tourism and the Capitol box office is.
Right.
That was the Stevenson building.
Yes.
When I first was opening up, I was in the lobby of the Capitol Theater while Rod Stewart, who owned the building, was fixing the other one up for us to move in.
Right.
And then for about 8 months. And then, of course, you couldn't be there in the winter. And the other one then got opened.
Right.
Yeah.
That just sparked another question. In those days, in, say, the late 80s, early 90s, was the business seasonal by any means? Like, did you get a lot of traffic in the summer and did it slow down more in the winter?
We definitely got a lot more traffic in the summer, but you'll find at that time antique searchers were diehards. They were out looking all the time.
Sure.
There wasn't the internet where they could sit behind with their fuzzy slippers, you know, with what they collect, clicking on buy now.
Sure.
And it was all weather-based in the winter. The other thing is I was still, I'm very fortunate that I do not rely on tourists.
Right.
I've built up such a good base of clients locally, like, and we're talking from Ottawa, Peterborough, Toronto. There aren't many antique and estate jewelry shops around. And I'm on fourth generation families now doing their jewelry.
So yes, you mentioned that you have sourced a wedding ring for one of your clients' great-granddaughters. Is that
yes,
what it
was? I made actually their great-granddaughter a wedding ring from their great-great-grandmother.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And being able to take that piece and know what that piece symbolizes and what it means really embodies a lot. There's
yes.
a lot of a story there, really.
Yes, yes. And then I'm also one of these people that if we take stones out of a ring, I insist the family keep the original setting.
Right.
Make notes with it, and they put it in a safety deposit box, which is the safest place in the world, so they can always go back to being original. But
sure.
again, fashions change and styles change,
certainly.
But they still have that history to continue to pass on.
Very fascinating. I'm speaking with Kendra Simmons of Antiques on Queen in downtown Port Hope. We're just going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and talk about the business which you operate. Thanks. Welcome back to Business Insights with John Racine. I'm speaking with Kendra Simmons of Antiques on Queen in downtown Port Hope. We just took a little break there. We just talked about owning our business in downtown Port Hope and what really makes our business. We started mentioning your staff, the people that work at Antiques on Queen, and you kind of shot up, got really bright and just wanted to talk about the wonderful people that work in your store. Would you be able to just tell me about how many people work in the store?
Currently 7 people.
You have a varied background. So you have people that have specialties in different things. You have people that have a different way of communicating. What would you say you're most proud of amongst the different styles and different techniques that people use? What does it all culminate to, really?
I guess it's when you find each person what their interest is and what they're good at, and you mentor it and bring it out in them and let them share that. So we've got some young people who only do Instagram. We have somebody else who loves to do Facebook. We have someone who loves to do stylists of the outfits and designs in the store. Her oldest employee loves to do displays in store windows, and she's amazing at it. So we just take the best of everyone and make it one whole big product.
That's fantastic. That's really good because ultimately your customer experience or your client's engagement, you have different people who have different styles, and they can work really well with new potential clients and customers. What do you think is the most important thing that you're able to help them guide through in their journey to being the best version of themselves?
You just have to find what somebody's good at and what makes them shine, and just keep engaging them to do it more and more and build up self-confidence. We started with some people who were like 12 and 13 years old who would come in as little helpers on the weekend for 2 or 3 hours, just learning about things, seeing about what retail is like, seeing what dealing with customers is like. Some were collectors. Actually, a lot of them came into the store because they were collectors. Mm-hmm. And then over time, got them to develop to the point that some of them actually came and worked every summer and over holidays and put themselves through university with us and then moved on. One of them got a GEM degree, but most of them, Black women's studies at Harvard University, 2 doctors, 1 dentist. It goes on and on. And I'm still in contact with most of them from almost 40 years.
Wow.
When I see them, and they have their families, and they've all just, you just have to give somebody a little bit of self-esteem and confidence, and it's amazing how far they can go.
And it's also amazing what starts from a hobby that cultivates into something more of, you get a good taste of it, you become more of a specialist into it, and then if you give them the right venue, they can now just grow and flourish into the people that they turn out to be, really.
Yes, and retail is a good place to start with that, because it's constant interaction with every type of person. And so they learn to communicate and they learn to do face-to-face. In retail right now, relationships is your only currency. Mm-hmm. Because everyone can buy online. And that's what I think has kept us so strong over the years, is that relationship. When I'm able to do that many generations, but then the staff learn that and they're part of that relationship. I have people who don't want to talk to me. They just want to come in and see Daphne, or they want to come in and see Sharon.
Sure.
And it's a relationship that they've developed. Mm-hmm. They know that person, sometimes some private things, sometimes just more about their family, and they're all engaged. And I think it's keeping people engaged.
Right.
And just any person has self-worth. So if you take anybody and just tell them that they're important, they will develop into just amazing people.
That's fantastic. I want to just know a little bit more about the business as it is today. You have your store on Queen Street in Port Hope. You walk in the door. There's a lot of visual right there. You can see all kinds of different pieces throughout history. In some cases, you have little, I would say, trinkets or different things like that that are collector's dream. You have jewelry that is attracting maybe a little bit of a different clientele. Tell us a little bit about the store as a whole right now, just for the listeners to understand a little bit about what they would experience when they came into the store.
So first thing is, when you come in, we have a step. And when you're busy looking at the chandelier, you might miss the step. So we have a big sign that says, watch your step. That's the first thing when you walk in our door. The chandelier. Everybody's, oh my God.
Welcome to the store. Sorry. Please don't trip and fall on all our, really priceless stuff.
The gasp. You know, we have things from 50 cents to in the thousands, because there's something for everyone. Every single purchase has to be special, no matter what they're spending. It's, again, it's the experience that we want people to have. And we're also known for, we're not pushy salespeople. They'll say, how come you're not like helping me? It'll talk to you.
Sure.
If you're looking for something specific, we will try to find it. And if we don't have it, I will go out of my way to help you find it. That's the whole point. You're looking for something specific. Or you walk in and it talks to you and it's something you want.
If you don't see it and you have something in mind, you're certainly the person that's going to help source that.
Yes.
People window shop, or people look around and say, you know what, it's not exactly, maybe somewhere else has it. But the best thing in that situation would be to communicate what that thing is, and you probably have a much better handle on trying to find that object as well.
Yes, and that's the first thing when people come in. We just say, you're looking for anything specific? And if not, we'll say, well, here's sort of the rooms. We have 3 floors, so we kind of direct them in different areas and say, if you have any questions, ask. But again, if you're looking for something specific, we'll try to first help them home in on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have these estate sales. You can gather different items, and sometimes they're auctioned off at the location, potentially?
Well, my brother, and he brings in specialists like ourselves, he actually runs the auctions.
Okay.
Or we run the content sales. It really depends on what is at the estate. the best way to dispose of it. Sometimes there's only a few items, and then we'll buy them or broker them for the estate, especially if it's a rare, expensive piece of art or something. Sometimes we will broker it. But the nice thing is that the people know that we will come in, and when we're done, that house is completely empty and clean.
Sure. I kind of want to just focus in on jewelry right now. At the back of the main floor there, you have your jewelry area. Tell us just a little bit about the variance in the different kinds of items that you would find at your store.
Everything from, I guess the earliest is 1770s, right up to some current designs. Again, when you do an estate, it doesn't have to mean it's 100 years old.
Sure.
Or a lot of people change their style and their fashions.
Yes.
What they're wearing, their lifestyles have changed. So they might have had something made or have something that they recently purchased, but it's not part of their lifestyle anymore. And sometimes we'll work out where they'll exchange that for something else. We do not buy from the public walking in off the street.
Right. It's not a pawn shop.
It's not a pawn shop.
Yeah. Okay. So you have an item from the 1770s. What exactly would that item be, or range of items would be from such an era?
This little mourning pendant, like a little engraved pendant, and a ring is what we have from that age right now.
So you must see quite a change in style from that era. Would somebody come in and buy that as a collector, or would somebody buy that, do you believe, to actually wear?
A bit of both. Again, it depends on the fragility of the piece. I get into the mid-Victorian, there's a lot of hair jewelry and mourning jewelry, and it is very fragile. Some of the late Victorian little lavaliers, again, are very fine. Mm-hmm. We sold those for weddings, for a bride to wear.
Okay.
So it's something to pass on, but not something to wear every day. And that's the other thing, when people are looking at certain things or for gifts, my first questions are, what do they do for a living? Is this something they'll be wearing every day?
Yes.
If they want to have a pearl ring or an opal ring, I explain that's probably not a good everyday wear ring because you can't wash your hands with it. It's fragile.
Right.
So we have to look at a lifestyle and what will tailor to that. Or again, a collector who maybe wears it occasionally, but it also is that they collect that thing, that item, that period of time.
Right. And are you seeing a lot of people coming in really specifically looking for something maybe based on birthstone or?
Yes.
Yes. So that's a big one.
It still is.
Yeah.
The birthstone one. And again, a lot of that, though, is an older demographic buying for their grandchildren.
Okay.
As opposed to young people coming in and saying, I want my birthstone. Usually they're looking for exotic stones or they're things that are a little bit, right now for weddings and engagements, we do a lot of rose cut diamonds and old cut diamonds.
Okay.
It's again become a fashion again. So it's, as people's tastes change, we try to evolve with that.
So could you just tell me just a little bit about the process? You have a ring, somebody wants it, and this is just elementary information.
Yes.
Somebody wants that resized.
Yes.
What are you physically doing to resize a ring? How does that work?
Well, it really depends on what the ring is.
Okay.
Again, if it's anything organic, like coral, opal, it can't be heated. So I'm fortunate that I have someone who has a laser. So now we can size these things, just like pearl brooches. 10 years ago, you couldn't fix any of these things, anything with enameling, because there was heat involved.
Yes.
Now with lasers, this can all be reworked, fixed, and revitalized. Or a ring can be sized. People buy rings, I guess rings, I should, because generally that's the only thing that needs sized or altered on a cruise ship. Well, a lot of those have been color enhanced or oiled. So the moment if you go to heat them, they lose the color.
Yes.
So 10 years ago, I'd say, you know what, I'm
can't
not comfortable sizing it. Now we can because you're not putting any heat to it. So there's all of
that's
those questions. And then if it's just a good, nice, plain shank with the diamond, I do not split on the bottom and stretch. I do on the sides, both sides. And alter it that way so there's no pressure on the setting. Some jewelers just put it on a mandrel and hammer it out, or some just cut it and stretch it out.
Interesting. Okay. When you're about to say, for example, if you had lost your diamond in your ring and there's a broken piece or something like that, and they come to you and say it needs to be refitted, instead of this changing the size, what would the process be like in reconstructing what is holding the ring?
Those might be claws or prong set.
Yeah.
So again, it's just, if it's just diamonds, you can use heat. You can make new claws. But again, if it's any other stone, you can laser it. You can laser new claws.
So this is a very detailed job, right? Like, I mean, it's very, are you able to do that on site?
I don't do work on site anymore. Okay. I do it from home.
Okay.
Or now sometimes I'm sharing a friend's workbench because, with insurance, with torches, with everything else,
certainly,
it's definitely getting harder to be able to do that. Also, he's got the best laser, and we've got like a 3D printer, and we're printing waxes. And it's just unbelievable now what you can do with new technology.
It certainly is. And I guess people are mostly concerned about the preservation of the actual item as well. It's not just, can you make this bigger or can you fit this back in? The biggest concern people usually have is, well, I hope that it still holds its integrity throughout this process of redesigning, and that's something people should be assured by in this process.
Yes, and that's when a lot of times people are coming in with their family ring and they're just not quite sure. I tell them to go home, think about it, bring in some pictures, we'll come up with some ideas, but always keep the original setting.
Yes.
Because the amount of gold that's in it is so limited as far as dollar value. It's only usually 3 or 4 grams, but also you can't use that gold again without having it re-alloyed and sent and be reworked, which is a very expensive process.
Yes.
So sometimes people say, no, I have to use the gold that's in there. Not a problem. I have to send it to be re-refined and bring it back because we don't know what it's been mixed with, what it's been alloyed with.
That's
if it's been repaired a few times, that will all affect the integrity of the gold. So to just melt it down and hammer it out, it might have cracks or it might have weaknesses that you cannot see.
Yes.
That's why I say keep the setting. We'll make you a whole new one, and it can always go back.
Sure.
Always go back.
Antique Roadshow. I'm just going to do an aside here. Antique Roadshow, all these shows, I lived in the UK for a while. They're on like 24/7 over there. In your business, though, do you ever have these moments where somebody comes in and they're just like, well, you know, I just found these rings. It was in mom's jewelry box, and there's this... like, this is an amazing piece. This is worth a tremendous amount. And this person had no clue what this piece even was. Are these moments of shock fun or interesting for you? Or is it just kind of more or less, this is kind of the day-to-day. This is the usual thing that we see all the time. What would that kind of moment be like?
There are aha moments. I had the opportunity to repair, and I was fortunate to be able to repair this, was a diamond set scarab necklace that was worn to the coronation of Queen Mary.
Okay.
That was unbelievable, but it had been an original box. The box had been shut, and one of the scarabs or two of them had been crushed.
Oh,
and we're talking real scarabs.
Wow.
So they're petrified scarabs. I was able to find 2 scarabs the right size to restore this necklace. It eventually will go to a museum.
Wow.
But that was like, I still see it. Like, you know, you dream about
moment.
Certain things. Yeah, and it is nice sometimes to give people a surprise and they had no idea. Pearls are a good one. How many people come in and I've got all these, and they try to say, I'm sorry, they're not real pearls. Because back in the 20s and 30s, pearls were more valuable than diamonds because they only dove, they weren't cultured yet. Or, again, as technology changes and availability, prices have changed. But the big story was the woman who traded her, I believe it was Cartier, might be corrected, traded her brownstone on Fifth Avenue for a natural pearl necklace.
Wow, okay.
And that's where Cartier still stands. Or again, I might stand corrected, but it was a high-end jewelry store.
Wow.
So that's how valuable they were at that time.
Certainly.
But it is always fun to see. And a lot of times people just want a little bit of history of the piece and a lot of great costume jewelry. Some costume jewelry is worth more than precious jewelry, depending on designer and style and everything else.
Certainly. Absolutely fascinating. We're speaking with Kendra Simmons of Antiques on Queen in downtown Port Hope. We're just going to take a quick break and we're going to come back in our final segment. Welcome back to Business Insights with John Racine. I'm speaking with Kendra Simmons of Antiques on Queen in downtown Port Hope. Kendra, so you've moved back to Port Hope, you run your store, but at the same time, you're also raising a family. I just wanted to kind of get an idea around, you're running this store, it's clearly not a 9-to-5 kind of job. This is something you're putting your heart and soul into, you're making sure you can grow this, you're building your clients. Tell us a little bit about managing, raising children in a small town, as well as running a business. What was that like for you?
I think I was fortunate and not fortunate at the same time. My husband was home and I was able to travel, and I traveled a lot. At one time we would do 40 shows a year, antique shows a year. It was nothing to be away. And because we have a span between our kids, our first one, we're able to take him with us. And I remember he was like 4 days old and on a sheet underneath the table at an antique show.
Right.
You adapt. And the other advantage is we had a big house. So when we had their other children, we're able to have a live-in nanny, which right. really, really made a big difference.
Right.
And economically, because it was cheaper to have someone live in than to pay for all this daycare.
Right.
The kids were in their own home. We did it the opposite way of most people. In the old days, in the antique world, it was mainly older people who were antique dealers in their retirement. Then there was this whole new guard that started that were young people starting right out. Probably should have had a real job first with no health benefits and pension plans and then became antique dealers. But we kind of did it in reverse because partway through, my husband actually got what we call a real job. Right.
Right. That's an interesting perspective. We're becoming more and more, I would say carefully, kind of a bit of an entrepreneurial society where people are kind of going right into the vocation of choice right out the gate and kind of bypassing that experience years working for somebody else, getting those kind of security things like, as you say, benefits and pension all built in. What would you say to somebody who is kind of right? And this may be the advice you just provided. Somebody's in high school or somebody's in university or college who's looking to go into a field very similar to yours. What advice would you give to that person? What should they be doing now in order to prepare themselves either for this vocation or the entrepreneurial experience?
I guess, first of all, if you're married, you have to have a very supportive spouse. Or that your spouse is your partner in that business where you can do time sharing. But it doesn't always work for everyone where you live your work together all the time. It doesn't always work. If you're young, you can take risks. You can be all in. You might have to live at home or you might have to couch surf because it is very expensive to be living. And I guess that's it. First, make sure that you have food on the table, mm-hmm. clothes on your back, mm-hmm. and then just go all in. But again, it's having that support. If you have family support in any way, I think that it's definitely easier for people to get ahead. But then for other people, it makes them hungry if they have no support. Right. And sometimes it's that hunger that, you know, you hear about all these multimillionaires and entrepreneurs who started by living in a house with seven people with no income. Mm-hmm. It's that hunger mm-hmm. and that desire. But I think they only succeed if that hunger and desire is in something that makes them passionate. Many people think that they're just going to become millionaires overnight. You have to love what you're doing. If you wake up every day and you don't love what you're doing, you really want to reassess what your life is about.
Certainly, certainly. This is a bit of a follow-on question, something that may come up with a similar answer, but you're now looking back at your own self, say 30 years ago or further, to ask, right when you're starting your business, what is the type of advice that you would give Kendra from that era to say something you know now that you didn't know then?
It was a lot easier when we started. I remember the first time we needed a bank loan to buy an estate. We went to the bank, and this was in Ottawa, and he said, well, what's it for? And we told him, oh, I like those. Okay. Gave us the money, shook our hand, because he knew that we would pay him back. Now, to get financing or anything, they want your house, they want your firstborn or your secondborn. Sometimes
sure.
we considered that. But it's different how you finance things. And I think we had become incorporated early on because there was tax benefits. But we were also doing X number of dollars to make it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
As you pair and change and things have changed, I think you need to have the proper accountant or financial person to help you set it up through the way. I wish we had done that more because
right.
I maybe now we want to become unincorporated and it's a very expensive process.
Right.
Personally, but at the time it fit our needs. But I think, again, you need to have someone who's constantly aware of how things are changing, how tax write-offs are changing, and how they can help you save money for the future. We weren't able to do that until my husband did get that job.
Sure.
And then we maxed out everything possible
right.
that he could do in
right.
retirement because it was day-to-day. You
certainly.
Lived day-to-day and paid bills day-to-day, right?
Certainly.
And we always had that instilled in us about financing is you pay everybody back first and yourself last.
Yes.
And it's still that way. My staff get paid, I don't.
Right.
But that's the way it works. But a good financial person to help you.
Mm-hmm.
And I know now business development and schools have all of that help. And
right.
we didn't have any of that in those days.
Right. Okay. Can I just ask you a little bit about more of your day-to-day? I always ask this question about habits. Now, not everybody has habits that they use every single day, but there may be certain habits that you developed at the beginning of your career or adapted them later in your career, habits that help you in your business or help you personally. And I ask this question because a lot of people who are trying to start out at the beginning of their career or who are into their career are always looking for something to help them propel them further. And certain habits or certain skills that people learn allow them to either sit back and think about what they're doing or plan for the future. Are there any habits that you've developed that you would say has helped you grow your business? And that may be a certain skill that you apply each time you do something. Something that you think has been valuable for you?
For me, it's just more that relationship with your customer and to make everyone feel welcome and feel special, whether they buy something or not. Mm-hmm. When they walk in the door and they leave the door, if they're leaving happy, I feel like I've accomplished something. I guess a quick little story. I had a woman who many years ago, it was a big challenge to buy something for her daughters, and they were $20 each, and she took hours, and I made sure it was the right gift. And over time, she always came for those gifts, and it was the experience, and she loved the experience. You don't judge who walks in your door, ever. Mm-hmm. And some retailers do, by what you're wearing, how your presence. And for us, we just learned a long time ago, especially in the antiques trade, mm-hmm. Collectors are kind of really odd. And mm-hmm. So they could be multimillionaires, you wouldn't know. But anyway, this lady one day came in and had a whole bunch of things laying on the counter. My staff were helping her. And I went, oh, it must be a special anniversary. And she said, yeah, I just can't decide. And then I left the room. And then my staff came up and said, she's buying it all. And I said, oh, my goodness. And she said, I've had a windfall. And she said, it was never about what you sold me. It was always every day how you made me feel.
That's fantastic.
And she won the lottery.
I really like that.
She's one of my best clients.
Yeah, no kidding. And I think that's really important, really. And I think that's important to identify that as well. It translates in all your staff, right? You learn this by watching somebody who's been doing it for a long time, and that really comes across for every customer experience. I think that's essential. I think that's fantastic. So you've been a business owner in downtown Port Hope. What would you say about the community of Port Hope or the community of the downtown business owners? What has that really meant for you to be a part of?
Again, it's just the community, and it's the business owners, but it's the people on the street. And we have a lot of great characters. We have that story, but it takes a village. We do have people that everyone in town watches out for. And that, to me, is the most important part of it all. And I'm sure in larger cities, they all have their sub-communities within Yes. them, too. And you have this vulnerable people, and we all just work together. And the thing is that when there's something needed in the HBIA or downtown Port Hope, they come together. Three years ago now, one of the town employees got very ill, and we made a point of having a fundraiser. That's right. And within 6 days, we put this on and made almost $16,000. So when it's needed, the community works really well together.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. Just wrapping up here, I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about how people can connect with you, phone number, email, Facebook, everything like that.
Yes, we try to make it accessible to everyone. So we do have a telephone. And we actually have a landline. So they can call the shop, 905-885-9858. But also they can email us, antiquesonqueen@bellnet.ca. Facebook Messenger, Instagram Messenger. The staff are always on top of all of that. But we try to make it accessible for everyone. And we are in the phone book.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, Kendra. My name is John Racine. This is Business Insights with John Racine. You can see us on Facebook, Business Insights with John Racine, and as well on our website, johnmeansbusiness.com. Thank you very much.